Okay, good morning. Welcome to this workshop. How many new teachers here? Just curious what our numbers are. All right. Very good. God bless you all. Let's read this verse first of all. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. Neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being in samples to the flock. I want to pick out a few key things from this verse. But let's first of all talk about Christ and the authority that Christ had and how he used that to minister to people. A few ways I thought of. Christ had authority over the devil. Christ used that authority over the devil to cast out the devil out of people and therefore serve the people through using his authority. Christ had authority over the thoughts of people, and that's one for sure that you don't have. But he had authority over the thoughts of people and that he knew them. How did he use that? Well, sometimes he told people what they were thinking and could really target their needs and say, I know what you're thinking. This is what's going on, and here's the problem. He had authority over nature so he could calm the storms to serve people. And I think the greatest way that he used his authority to serve people was when the ear was cut off. Somebody swung the sword, cut the ear off. His authority over nature healed the man who certainly wasn't deserving of that. His authority as a savior, I don't know if I'd really say over sin. In a sense, I suppose that was true. But as a savior, he had authority. And he used that to forgive sins. And so I would encourage you to think of how did Christ use his authority? If there was anyone who had authority and could have used that in a way to enjoy that authority, it certainly would have been Christ. And we see him over and over using his authority to bless people. And I think that's one thing I just want to emphasize over and over in this workshop. Is the authority that you are being given must be used exclusively for the good of your students. That's going to be hard. Those who've taught know that. Because it's easy to use authority for other reasons and motives. And we'll look at those as we go through this workshop. Well, let's look at some of these keywords. First of all, before looking at the actual keywords, I'd just like to emphasize, feed the flock of God. Now, I know this was given not to a teacher, but to a minister, but I think it still applies. You are responsible to feed the students of God. These are not your children. Now, I've taught my daughter 2 years, and I really enjoyed that, but that's outside of a few times that might have happened, even if it's your sibling. They are not your children. And I think that helps us to put a context of our authority. It is given to us for a particular purpose. It's not our right. It's not our children in which we would have a right to have authority over. It is given to you by parents and by the school board for a particular purpose and a particular time. Remember, they are not your children. You are being trusted with these children and given authority over these children that is simply given to you for a particular time and purpose. And then that authority stops at the end of the day, doesn't it? All right, let's look at some of these words. Oversight. Oversight simply means being an overseer. And I know I'm using this now in teacher context, and so we're maybe tweaking these words a little bit. But you, as authority, are given oversight. You are the overseer of the classroom. All the authority is vested in you. And other administration, possibly. But in the classroom, it is your responsibility. You are given oversight. It is your job to see what is going on in the classroom. Willingly. I don't know if any of you have been hired in the last few weeks. That's one thing that we do here at Faith Builders is we allow people who were hired since the deadline of July 25 to still come to Faith Builders because you maybe need to be here. I don't know if any of you were hired that recently. Maybe if you were, you don't feel like you were hired willingly. Or that you're taking this responsibility willingly because you almost had to take this responsibility, not by constraint. I hope you still don't feel constrained to do it or forced to do it. If so, you might still want to reconsider. And then we are called in a sobering way to be pattern and samples. It actually means a pattern to be copied or followed. You, teacher, are to conduct yourself in a way that those under you can look at you and say, now that is how I should live. That is how I should respond. That is how I should behave. You are to be a pattern that can be duplicated in every way and say, that's good, that's right, that's the will of God. You know, if you're not humbled as a teacher, something is wrong, okay? If you come today feeling quite qualified, I hope to dequalify you somehow. I don't care how long you've taught. In fact, I think a lot of us could testify that the longer we teach, the more we feel unqualified in some ways. Obviously, the content of the material we know better. Teaching skills we know better. We know how to use the board possibly. We know some of those skills. But the weight of responsibility grows. I love to talk to new teachers that are teaching a few months and say, now, do you feel more qualified or less qualified than you did before you began school? And they often say, less. That's to encourage those who are first-year teachers. All right, let's move on to purpose. And we're going to kind of loop through these things a couple times because I want to look at it more from a broad philosophy standpoint, maybe a concept of authority, and then look at it again in a more practical way, a lot more practical. So what is the purpose of authority? Why do we have authority? And what are views of authority? So I'm going to go to the first point, A. A way to greatness is how the Gentiles would see this. And I got this from a story in the Bible, and you know this story. I'm not going to read the whole story, where a mother brought her two sons and made a very unusual request and said, could one of my sons, when you are great, Jesus, when you have a kingdom, Jesus, could one of my sons sit on the left hand and one on the right? Isn't that an amazing request? You talk about audacity. I mean, to ask for one spot is one thing, but two spots? Quite amazing. What did Jesus say about this? Well, he said about, are you able to be baptized with my baptism and suffer? And he said, yes, we are. Okay, well, Jesus then went on to the next thing and said, okay. He said, ye know that the princes, this is now talking to the disciples who are irritated. The other 10 are irritated at this request, and understandably so. And Jesus called them unto him. Jesus wanted to explain something about this type of request. Okay, what does he explain? Ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you, but whosoever will be great, greatness in terms of God's thinking and values, if you want to be great in that way, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister. When we looked at a few of those examples, didn't we? How Christ came to minister through using his authority and to give his life. I was impressed with that word as I read that again this morning. Give. That's what it means to be authority. In authority is to give. And to give his life. His life, a ransom for many. Certainly, we find Christ being the greatest example in every way of using his authority to bless and serve other people. All right, so the way to greatness is the Gentile concept. I'm going to use that word Gentile because that's what Jesus said here. A way to be great is to have authority, and I can use that authority to advance who I am, give me that feeling of power. You know, we men maybe struggle with that a little more than the ladies. Now, I don't know for sure, but I would suspect that maybe it's a little more of a temptation for the men. There's something about authority, power, making people do what we want them to do, calling the shots, having them move accordingly, that just, I don't know what it is. I guess it's ego. I don't know, men. What do you think it is? It's something in there that it just kind of fuels and feeds that. That's wrong. That's not why you were given authority by the parents. That's not what they had in mind, and certainly not the board either. The biblical concept is the way to servanthood. Authority is a tool, okay? Authority is a tool so that you can better serve people. Is it true that the more authority you have, the more you can serve and the more ways you can serve? Is that true? The more authority that is vested and trusted to you, the more you can abuse that, most certainly, That's very obvious and easy to see in the world in which we live. And in your own experience, you can understand that. But also, it gives you greater opportunity. Okay, how many of you are administrators here or principals? Any? Okay, a number of people are. You can serve more people and in more ways because of that position than a teacher can, because you have more responsibilities. And with those more responsibilities, gives you more avenues to reach into the homes, to speak into needs, and to just labor among your students to serve because of that authority. See, there seems to be a little tension between these two words, doesn't there? Authority. Well, that's because of the Gentile thinking that still is in our heads sometimes. The wrong view of authority and servanthood. They seem to be so different. Look at slavery in the past. Look at leaders and people who were dictators, men who were dictators. Authority is power, controlling people. And the servants were stripped of authority. But that's not in God's economy. That is not how God looks at it. God is saying authority means opportunity to serve. It's a tool. All right. Now I'm going to go back to the negative again and kind of loop through this again in a more practical way. Exercising authority, point two, and this is obviously where we want to spend most of our time. Self-serving. Authority can be self-serving. And I want to look at some very practical ways in which authority can be used to be self-serving. First of all, I would encourage you to take some time to understand your own personality and teaching style and see how that shapes the exercise of your authority. And you know what? Some of that is going to happen, and that's okay. Those who are cholerics, if you know what these words mean, but they're a little more domineering type of people. I mean, they tend to be, that's what I meant. They're a little more bold. They've got a lot of courage. They're really afraid of people. So they tend to exercise their authority a little bit out of that personality. Those who are sanguines and love people and love children and love to just be everybody's friend tend to then, of course, exercise authority in the context of that personality. Well, one thing's for sure, teaching will change you somewhat, but you are still going to be you. And so you will live out of, you will exercise authority to a greater or lesser degree, probably greater, out of the context of who you are. But understanding that, thinking about that, understanding the inherent weaknesses that come with your personality is important. So I would encourage you to take some time, not necessarily now, to say, how would I naturally exercise authority? What are my tendencies? And what are the weaknesses that go with that? And then be careful. So let's take this right into the next point, because here is where I want to flesh this out just a little more. What are the fears that a teacher faces if their personality is very much so geared towards students and relationships? This is a very interesting question for you new teachers to ask yourself. What is the consuming fear as I go into the classroom? Most teachers, unfortunately, I'm saying this very kindly as I can, unfortunately say, I want my students to like me. And if you taught a few years, you still want your students to like you. But if that is kind of the big thing that looms in front of you, we do some student teaching in our school, and I love the one question we ask, what is your greatest concern or fear that the students will not like me? It's big. Or that they won't accept me as their teacher. Why is that so big? Well, because we're threatened by these little children, right? And we know they can go home and tell stories about us. And they can say things at church about their teacher. And so we go into the classroom with this fear that the students are not going to like me. That can be for new teachers, and it can also be for teachers who are experienced and have had difficult relationships with their students. Or maybe, worse yet, you got the same boy or girl coming back who obviously did not like you last year, and therefore you have reasons to assume you're going to begin the year where you left off. And so this is working on your nerves. How can I win the heart of this student? What can I do about this? Well, it's not wrong to be concerned about students accepting us and a good relationship. But we'll make some huge mistakes if that is sort of the all-consuming concern. And kind of intoxicated with that concern. I think a few indications of this would be this kind of thing. You're unsure in making decisions. Now, this is a trap we probably all fall into. You know, often there's one or two or three people, often just one or two, and sometimes one, who we are the most concerned about keeping happy in the classroom. Do you know what I'm talking about? I hear somebody giving a chuckle. It makes me feel so much better. There's that one person, maybe two. They are the bully. It's often a boy, but sometimes it's a girl. They scowl very quickly, so they're not happy. Other people look at him or her to see if everything's okay. Here's a classic example. We want to play a game at activity or recess. What should we play today? And right away we're, you know. And even the students kind of shoot a glance at this person to see what would be okay. Because they're also sometimes concerned about keeping this person happy. And so we talk and we're just trying to be intuitive. Should we play peek around the corner? And you know, and I know we played that, you know. Oh, yeah, we played that a lot recently. Let's see. What about kick the tin can? And we did play that recently because he's still scowling. And then you say, well, yeah, let's see. What else can we play? You're trying to think. And they're yeah, hey, you know what? Kickball would be fun, wouldn't it? Hey, what do you think? Let's play kickball today. Y'all agree? And they all like, yeah, let's play kickball. And say, y'all raise hands for kickball. You're trying to keep this one student happy because if they are happy, probably everybody's happy is the assumption that we're making. If that's what's going on, your authority is being used to please your students, and hopefully in the end, they're gonna like you. I can remember a student one time and say, I tend to be this kind of a person, okay, so I understand this all too well. And I remember, you know, we're kind of back and forth, volleyball or softball. And I can't remember a particular student of mine, although I could probably imagine who it might have been if I could think of the exact year. And after a while, a student said, just decide. Just decide. Don't worry about that one or two who scowls on the way out through, and I'm so sick and tired of playing that. Decide what we're going to play. You know, that is what the students want to see you do. They want you to be decisive. Make some decisions and say, you know what, we played volleyball yesterday. I know a lot of you like playing volleyball, but for the sake of the few who like playing softball or the other way around or whatever game it is, I think it's respectful to play that. And I think we can all get in there and enjoy it. So let's play softball. You're excused. That's the best thing you can do because you're using your authority to do the best thing to do for your students. And when you get into that wishy-washy and you're not sure about this, and then, well, maybe that way, and we'll count the votes again here because, you know he's unhappy or she's unhappy. It's playing a game that you really don't want to play. Another thing to do is to try, another thing that you can find yourself falling in this whole trap of them wanting to like you, is making school fun. Is that a good word? I want school to be fun. Do you tell your students that? We are going to have fun this year. School is going to be exciting and fun. And they're like, yes, yes. Oh, God, are we going to have a lot of extra recess this year? Oh, yes, of course we will, because we want school to be fun. And are we going to take time to do this? Why, sure, that's a great idea. Somebody said, don't smile till Thanksgiving. Now, that's a stretch, but there was a point. There was a point. You know what? If you're going to have a party every day or even every week, you are going to run out of ideas as to what to do that is so exciting and so fun and creates diversity so they like school, so they like me. And about Christmas, you're going to be sick and tired of the party, and they are going to be sick and tired of you or the party, let's say. But it's going to loop back and be against you. All right, do we want school to be fun? Well, sure, we want school to be fun. Depends how you use that word, I suppose. Do we want school to be a party with lots of diversity and lots of exciting things and with just new ways of doing things and breaks from the hard work? No, absolutely not. We must make our classes exciting, enjoyable, and draw our students into what's going on. And diversity is used occasionally to spice up the day or the week, wintertime or those type of things. But the average day does not need to be fun in that way. So I would urge you as teachers, new teachers especially, who are trying to think of many ways to be very creative and keep school awfully exciting, make sure you don't fall into that trap of I want school to be fun. And do a lot of those things at the beginning of the year, because soon we can hardly back this thing up. Because they do get used to it, and even though they're getting sick of the lack of schedule, they don't understand when you try to rein this thing back in. We didn't have extra recess now for 3 days. And while you're trying to tighten things down, we're not getting through the books very, very well, whatever. And they don't understand what you're doing, and you'll be disappointed, I think, with the result of that. All right. Maybe we'll get to just a little more of that tendency later. Let's go to the other side. If your personality is a little stronger, a little more of a choleric, what are the fears that you might bring to school? It's not so much that they're not going to like me. It's maybe a little more that they are going to get away with stuff, and I don't like that. This maybe is more experienced teachers. You know, you maybe heard some stories over the summer of stuff they got away from. And that is really annoying, isn't it, to be honest? It is. Especially a former student. And let's see, I think I actually have, I don't know, a number here. But it really, so don't tell these stories, all right, to me or anybody else. All right. You tell this story of, ha-ha, when you went out of the room, we did this. They had no idea. Boy, oh boy, does that ever irritate us, doesn't it? If we're not careful, especially when we're operating out of a poor concept of our authority. But it can be a little more motivated. Our exercise of authority is being motivated by, I just don't want any trash going on and nonsense. Because I don't want to deal with those stories, or I don't want to know that stuff went on behind my back. And it has nothing to do with what is good for the student. It's all about how I am perceived as a teacher, and what's my image as a teacher. You know, if you go into the classroom like that, and again, I'm going to guess that's less of you going in that way than going in the more the fluffy way and wanting a lot of fun and friendship. But if you go into the classroom with, I'm going to keep this thing tight, this is baloney, some of this carrying on, you will set up a cat and mouse game from day one. And you want to be the cat, they will be the mouse. I can remember, and I want to say this carefully, but I think I can say this without you making any connections to people, but I can remember, this would be 20-some years ago, I suppose, going to Bible school, a particular Bible school, and there were some fellows there that had been in Bible school the year before, and many stories got out of the behavior of the previous year, and here these same fellows came back to Bible school with the same administration. Monday night, we had separate chapel. I don't know what's coming. We go down to the chapel, and we find out how they heard these stories from the previous year. Now, thankfully, I was not there that previous year, but some of the fellows that were there, of course, were being zeroed in on. I can still, and I won't imitate his voice because a few of you might figure something out here, but we will expel. We heard over and over again. We heard the stories from that year and the stuff you did in the dorm after the lights were out and the food you had when you shouldn't have had and the stuff that went on here. And some of you are here again. This year it's going to be different. We will expel. We are not going to have that going on. What do you think were the comments as we walked out of the room? This is going to be fun. I don't remember exactly what was said, but that was the feeling. You know, wow. Whew. You know, catch me if you can. They'll play the game. You handle yourself with that suspicion and watching. They will be the mouse if you want to be the cat, but neither of you are going to enjoy what's going on in school. See, I think it would have been a lot better for that administrator to stand up front and say, you know, we may as well be honest that last year didn't go very well. And some of you are here. And rather than ignore that, let's go ahead and talk about it. And you know, a whole year is a lot of time for you to mature and grow up. And I think we as administration probably made some mistakes as well. And so we really would like this year to go different than last year. And we're going to trust you as much as we can and try to ignore what happened until you prove that I can't trust you anymore. And at that point, we're going to have to decide what to do. But I hope we don't get to that point. Do you think those people would have been, those young people would have been motivated to go ahead and cooperate? Well, at least a few more, I think, would have been. At least it wouldn't have set up this thing of we're going to see what all we can do. And that's just one thing I want to emphasize, and that is when there is trouble, somehow you must push the reset button for your people. All right? Now, I know you can say, you don't know my situation. I know there are situations that do get wearing, and it seems like year after year, the school culture is really negative. And I pity teachers in those situations. I thankfully am not in that situation. But there are teachers. I just talked to one the other day who switched schools, and he said he was just so weary, the attitudes, just attitudes, attitudes. And he's finding here that he's enjoying it. And I don't want to judge all those as the teacher's problem. But I'll tell you what, you can feed the problem awfully easily, can't you? Very, very easily. By setting up that suspicion, you're watching everything, you're questioning everything. What's going on here? You jump around corners to see. Yes, they were whispering. You give that glance. After a while, what were you talking about? You know, it's just no fun. The tension just builds up and builds up in the class. I would suggest that you learn to ask questions instead of tell them what they did wrong. You will be glad sometimes. Ask questions. Even if you are sure you know what they were doing, ask a question. You're always just giving them opportunity to lie. Well, that's true, but I'll tell you, there's been times that I've asked questions about something that went on that I was awfully glad I was only asking a question. I wasn't telling them what they were doing wrong because I didn't see right. And it's all part of feeding that suspicion, feeding that I'm out to get you. Ask questions. Say, I thought I saw you and somebody swap something. Was that true? Yeah, we did. Mind telling me what it was? It was a CD. Okay. What happened? That's way safer than saying, I saw you handing something between each other. What went on? He needed a tissue. Oh, okay. Give him a tissue. You know. Oh. See, the teacher's out to get me. And we can't even just be normal because, right away, something's wrong. Or maybe they whisper and say something and laugh. Right away. So, feels like something disrespectful going on here. Well, what went on? I just told him that, you know, his shirt tail's out or his shoes. Oh, okay. Understand? Ask what happened. If they're dishonest, you have to work your way through that. But asking gives them an opportunity to say without, they know you're watching, you saw what happened, without giving them the impression, I'm out to get you. And I think this falls especially in more experienced teachers who are just emotionally getting just a little wore out. Okay? Maybe we like, and maybe this moves on to number three, other wrong motives. What are other wrong motives in being maybe this type of a person? Maybe we like to be known as a strict teacher. You know, that's actually a fairly positive thing. You maybe hear that once in a while. So-and-so. I remember a friend told me that about a man. He said, wow, when I went to school, you know, we didn't always appreciate him, but he said, looking back, he was actually a strict teacher, and he was a good teacher. Right away, it's like, oh, I want to be that kind of a teacher. I want to be strict, too, because that's good. Oh, no, what I'm being motivated by, again, the image that the community has of me as a teacher, rather than being motivated by what is best for my students. Here's another one that I think, again, really hits us as long-term teachers, and that is I just don't want any more hassles than I need to in school. I'm tempted a little bit with this in the longer I teach. Because I am married and we have 5 children and I have a fair amount of responsibilities outside of school. And you know, I just want school to be school and then I want to go home at 5:30, 6 o'clock and I'm done. And I just don't want any garbage hanging over me. And so things like this after school, I am so sick and tired of this. I'll tell you what, this is going to stop. What is motivating that comment? Now, we all make those comments sometimes, but hope we don't mean it quite that nasty, right? I mean, I hope you have a faculty that, you know, sometimes you kind of, I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, this child's writing, I can't even read, or this is the 3rd time this happened, or this is the 50th time this has happened. I mean, this is it. There are times where we, you know, But listen, when we sort the thing out and we decide how to administrate and what to do about it, the question comes back to one question. What is best for the student? Okay? What is best for the student? That is the only question. Because you're exercising your authority to bless this child. What is the best for this child? It is not, I'm so sick and tired of it, I just want some pain in this situation and I'd like to hurt him a little bit. I am so tired of this that just take the pressure off of me. I don't want to ever see this kind of thing again because I'm tired of it. But I call it the kind of the no hassles model. When I come into school, I'm a teacher. I've been doing this for a while and I know what I'm doing. I got my books, I teach it, and you do it right, and let's cooperate. It's really motivated because I just don't want those things hanging on me. I'm just tired of it. And as we get emotionally wore out as teachers, maybe some of you don't understand this that are younger, but I think some of you as experienced teachers start to understand the emotional wear of teaching year after year, and you just kind of, all right, let's cut this thing as clean as we can, make it happen, and just, then we're motivated from something that's wrong. I believe another one, last of all, in this section, and I know I'm mixing the positive and negative somewhat here together, but that is another wrong motive is to keep the children at an emotional distance. This is for those who maybe just their teaching style is. Okay, let me just run over this real quickly. We can say, and I think you could probably understand this, that there's somewhat three dimensions to teaching in terms of style this would be now. So I don't want to confuse this here, but let me try to explain this real quickly. One would be more the relationship. That's what really gets me cranked. What do I like about teaching school? I just love the children. One is a little more than I love the books. I mean, I love 3 o'clock. And they go home. And I get into my books, and I'm in my world. I look things up. I prepare my lessons. I love the study. And the other one tends to be a little more, I love teaching. I love the delivery of it. You know, the study's great and all that, but boy, do I love my outlines. I love to use the board. I love multiple colors. I love overheads. And I love teaching. I like lecturing, and then I like discussion groups. That's my thing, is to get in front of those students and tell them stuff and see them just, take that. You understand? So those, understand which one is your strength. And therefore, your weakness. Because you exercise authority somewhat, again, out of that motivation for teaching. A lot of us teach for more than one reason, I suppose. But I'm guessing that a lot of you could have raised your hand at saying, that's probably me. Right? Good of you? Okay. So those three, and maybe two out of those three. But probably, predominantly one. Now, back to what I'm saying. Those who like the books, it's all about books, tend to fall into this trap. Keep students at an emotional distance. They come in the morning and, hey, do you know what we did last night? And, yeah, so what'd you do? You know, oh, we went to, oh, really? That's neat. Yeah, wow, okay, yep. And then we went over here and just, oh, really? Okay, yeah. And, you know, let's get this over with. Or worse yet, they come in and they're almost in tears. What happened? Oh, my sister hurt herself last night really bad. Or mom's sick. And those things happen in school. Maybe worse yet, somebody died in the family, and you need to help them. But the tendency to keep them at an emotional distance because I just, you know, I'm about school, I'm about the books. And if I allow that emotional weight to come in on me, well, then I kind of carry that with me, and I got to show care and concern. Some of you are very caring about your students, and you would put your books down, and what happened? Well, that's too bad. Can I pray with you? How does that feel? Wow. How are you going to make it through the day? You going to be okay? You know, I'll understand if you're not paying very good attention because I'm sure that's a big weight on you, and you because that's your style. For others, again, it's that little emotional distance to just keep the hassles and the emotion away because, you know, at 5 o'clock I want to go home and I really don't want to be worrying about all of my students' problems yet because, you know, I have my own problems to worry about. All right. In the last little bit here, let's zero in on what are our advantages or ways that really create the servant heart toward our students? What are some things we should be paying attention to? What are some things that should create or be forthcoming from a true servant heart? It creates an atmosphere in which learning can take place. Teachers, you have authority and go ahead and call the shots to make it happen. All right? Just do. Listen, there's no reason that students choose where they sit in the classroom. That's your job. Now, maybe you say, well, that's our culture, and that's okay, but I would consider changing it. Why in the world would you tolerate two or three buddies who cause problems in the back of the room to dicker and hassle you and distract you and everybody else from learning day after day? I'd say, that's ridiculous. Break them up. It takes me a long time to do seating arrangements. Now, I teach anywhere from 20 to 30-some students, and so seating arrangement really matters. And even though they're high school, 9th and 10th grade students, they still like when we change desks often. And they know full well that I take a lot of care in where they sit. I sometimes tell them jokingly that, you know, in my mind, all of you are sort of like one, two, or three. One is, you're a really good student, you can sit anywhere and it's just no problem. Two, I'd be a little careful. And three, yes, I'm very careful where I place you. I already had a student ask me afterward, what number am I? Three. You have the courage to ask, you probably know that. I forget what, I think he maybe came in at a two. But anyhow, you are in control of the room and you must call the shots to make it orderly and decent so that learning can take place. So you're not using your authority there because you don't want any hassles, this is ridiculous, I'm tired of this whispering, you're driving me crazy. No, it's that this is the rule because you are the students and we want to get the job done. I want to teach without this whispering going on. You might have different rules in your school. Maybe some of you allow some, maybe some of you don't. Some of that's your personality. Some of that's also the behavior and culture of the classroom, whether they can handle some liberties or not, and the age in which that you're teaching. Lots of dynamics. I'm not going to tell you how to do it. Bottom line is, when you're ready to teach a class, it must be orderly enough that learning can take place. And there's no reason you're standing up front and you're trying to teach a class, but you just keep seeing this in your eye, this look between two people, the laughing or the note between. Stop. Not because you're so irritated, but because you're trying to teach these students. And you're going to use your authority to create an atmosphere in which learning and lecture can take place. Study halls that are reasonably quiet. I'm just curious, how many of you would have a pretty much zero tolerance for whispering in your room? Pretty much zero. Okay, and that's great and fine. I do that sometimes. I did that this last year a few times. I got more whispering, and I finally said, let's have a few silent days. And they took that extremely well. Some actually wanted to keep it that way. And I was surprised at that. I really was. How many of you would like, and I have 9th and 10th graders, so I can, you know, we can dialogue in a safe way a little more than you could with 4th and 5th graders, because they would always give ridiculous rules. By the time they're in 9th and 10th grade, it's amazing how strict rules they will often give. How many like that? Just quiet. A bunch of them. Of course, the ones who tend to be quiet raise their hands because they're distracted by those who talk. And so I was surprised how many they just like that quiet, quiet feel in the room. So we might do that for a week or two and then say, okay, you know, we'll allow a little more exchange as long as it's very, very subdued and questions about a lesson or something like that. You need to do what works with your particular dynamics, but create a place where lecture and learning can take place. Number two, servanthood, I think, seeks to show acceptance and appreciation for each student. I think you can use your authority to deal with cliques. This is more what's going on in the classroom among them. And deal with mocking students or a student who's always picked on. That is your authority to get that thing stopped. I would be surprised if any teacher would say, I don't know what you're talking about. But most of us have a student who either is not accepted or appreciated, or students who think they are so cool, or if they only know, but who think they are so cool that they can't talk to anybody else hardly. And it creates that tension in your room. Use your authority to say, this cannot happen. Gotta talk your way through that. Work with the bullies. Work with those who create the cliques or create the idea that somebody, you know, is out there somewhere and is to be mocked and laughed at, etc. On your end, as a teacher, be careful that you don't show favoritism to certain students. You know, you can use your authority to do that very, very easily. Now, don't get so obsessed that you can hardly make decisions as to how to mark things because you want to be fair. Now, this would apply especially to middle and upper grade teachers who do a lot of correcting in the class. What I do in my room is we correct almost everything in class, but I take no grades in class whatsoever, maybe two times in the year. I just don't, for two reasons. I want the papers going through my hands as a way to show respect for the work they put into it, and I don't want a student who always gets hundreds to say hundreds, and I don't want a student who gets low grades to have to say that every day either. Just takes the pressure off. So I collect everything. We grade the algebra, spot check it, or go through the whole thing. I collect it, it goes through my hands, and take some of those pressures off. But still, at the end of correcting, they raise their hand, you know, and is it such a good student? And they forgot to do something and say, well, I just marked it half wrong. You know, I'd hate to irritate that student, you know. And the next student who's sloppy already and just is asking this for the 30th time, you know, mark it wrong. You know, the more you can create policy that's just absolutely fair, the better. That's in relation to homework. I don't know if you have a homework policy. We finally did put one in place a few years ago, and it's worked reasonably well. After the first offense, this happens. Actually, nothing happens. And after the second one, this, third, fourth, et cetera, and then it gets reset every quarter. That has just really leveled the ground for teachers. What do I do if somebody doesn't have something done? Well, if it's the first time in the marking period, guess what? You get the grace of it's okay. You know, you need grace once in a while, don't you? You do? You ever get to class and didn't have something quite ready? Ah, I forgot. You stand at recess? No, you don't, right? So we have some grace. The second time, it's maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes of recess, and it builds up accordingly because obviously they're a rather irresponsible person. So I would encourage you to somehow create structure in your class and your school that you try to make things as fair as possible. That way there's not the emotion on the table when you make the call. I didn't follow directions. I didn't underline this one thing the whole way through. Is what happens. They're always half wrong. Or that's always a 10% consequence. Or that's a late paper. Something that makes it fair. I think you can use your authority in that way to show acceptance, appreciation for each student, and they all get treated the same way. And because students will watch it very carefully. And they'll notice if, yes, indeed, every time this person who's really a good student has something wrong, the teacher just tends to ease up a little bit. And this student who causes a lot of trouble here and there tends to, you know, get hammered just a little hard. You know, students will defend each other in that quite quickly, and you're going to be the one in trouble. I'm probably some of you have had embarrassing experiences doing that. I'll tell you one, since we have time to quickly tell this here. I use my authority in a very, very poor way many times, I'm sure. But one of the most memorable moments was teaching fifth grade, my first year of teaching. And I remember who it was. He is now, of course, an adult. I hope he does not remember this. But vocabulary, do you know the Rod and Staff vocabulary books where you have, no, not Rod and Staff, Pathway, vocabulary books that go with the readers where you have vocabulary words and then you fill in the 10 sentences or so and then something different down below that yet, I believe. Okay, well, this was fifth grade. And this boy was very sloppy, and he did deserve some pressure, but not this kind of pressure. And so he had written in as normal, very bizarre answers, pretty much the first word, I mean, just any word. They made no sense, even to a person who wasn't very bright with vocabulary. You could honestly, this is just ridiculous. And I made the terrible mistake of taking his book, and I read a few answers up front. And I think he was, I'm not sure if the person brought it and said, all of these are wrong, because we were correcting it in class. I'm not quite sure what happened there. But anyhow, I do remember having the book, and I read a few answers off. And it wasn't long before a little girl in the front was crying. And I mean, a girl crying, fifth grade. I mean, I'm a new teacher. This isn't, you know, what are you doing? Well, you know, what's wrong? You made fun of him, and you read his answers off. Yeah, I had made fun of him. And I can't quite remember if I apologized, but I sure hope I did, and I think I did. I said, I'm sorry. I was wrong. And if you do something like that, make it right. They will stick up for each other if you and your use of authority swat at somebody and intimidate them. Now, it can work pretty good sometimes to call that bully down, right, in the smart aleck. There are times to do that in a way that is appropriate. He was a smart aleck. He said something disrespectful. I think there can be a place to say, that's not acceptable to say in my room. And you move on. And whew, shut that thing down. There's a place to do that. But making fun of them, intimidating them, making them look really stupid, be awfully careful. There is a line at which you will get yourself in big trouble. Because you, and I've seen teachers do that, just make careless remarks or kind of mocking remarks. And well, students are becoming very, very sensitive to that, if it's against them or against a classmate, because sort of like brothers, you know, they can fight, but they can also be very defensive of each other. And you see that going on in your classroom. You know, they're a group here. They And they know each other well, and they will defend each other. So be careful with that. Number three, results in consistent expectations and discipline. We talked about that some already. Be careful with your moods. I don't know what you face. Some of us are more moody than others. And, you know, our moods go up and down. And one day we just feel pretty strict. And the next day we just feel like having a party. One teacher was told that they can tell, his students can tell what the day is going to be like by how his hair is combed. I taught with this man, and he thought he combs his hair the same every day. But I'm not sure if some days he slicked it over or slicked it back or front or greasier. I'm not sure what the differences were. But somehow, they actually, supposedly, he'd walk in the door, and they'd take a little look and say, ooh, careful. You know, this is a tough day. And the next day, hey, folks, I think we can have a little fun here, and it's going to be okay. I don't know how your students look at you. I don't know how my students look at me. Sometimes I do really wonder sometimes. Do they feel like some days I'm under pressure? I had a student already tell me because, you know, again, they're older and I can talk fairly honestly with some of them. And I know one told me, he said, you know, he can tell. I'm involved in a Thursday night Bible study, which is community children. And we can have up to 100 community children. It can be rather hectic, okay? And so I'm there a good bit. And I just cannot imagine, though, but he said that sometimes he thinks Friday morning I'm more stressed out because of the previous night. But that was good for me to hear him say that because, you know what, maybe that's true. Maybe somehow I come in with just a little more, you know, formal feel because at Bible study, believe me, you need a lot of, you know, just shut things down. If there's a problem, call people down. And maybe I kind of carry that with me Friday morning. I'm still kind of in that mood. And they can just see me just walk in with a little more intensity and a little more no-nonsense attitude. I'm not sure. Emotional weight outside of school that you can bring into school and create very inconsistent. Maybe socially, especially as young people, socially you're feeling like a misfit. It's not just going very well with your youth. Or maybe as a married person, there's stress at home. I mean, I've been through some of those quite stressful things in my 20 or 19 years of teaching. And things, you know, difficult things. And to try to bring yourself to a place where you can still teach. And maybe there's times you need to tell your students that. We lost our little son a year ago, a few months before school started. I did need to tell my students that this is going to be tough to start school, but I'm going to do the best I can. But I don't feel very normal, and I hope you can understand that. And I thought it was just better. 9th and 10th grade is very kind and supportive. But it was just good for me to go ahead and tell them, you know what, I don't feel very normal. And I hope you can be patient with that. Because I think probably some things, how I taught, but I felt like I dropped the ball a lot more often, even as an administrator, just didn't get things done like I should have gotten done. And I faced a lot of frustration in those first months, just trying to be everything and do everything. Well, maybe we need to just be honest and tell our students. You know, I'm facing some difficulties. Just be patient with me. Again, it depends on the age and the nature of the issue. Remember again, it's all about the student. I can't overemphasize that. It's all about the student. It is not about you. It is not about having a good day. It is not about getting through the day and feeling good about teaching. I love teaching. That is not the question. The question is, what is best for this student? Now, as much as I am for this point, results in consistent expectations and discipline, there is the flip side of which you must be intuitive to the need of each student. And all I can say is ask God for wisdom, because God has promised you wisdom. This is difficult. There is the side in which some children will be handled and dealt with differently than another child, given the situation. I would love to hear a discussion on this, but I don't know really where we would go with it other than coming back and saying you've got to learn to be flexible within a reasonable structure. You need to be flexible. It is not okay to say every time this happens, just like this. So that child who has this homework problem, and here's the policy, but you know full well going on at home is some really tough stuff. I would imagine that most of you teachers would say you deal with some emotional needs with your students. I would imagine if you teach in a larger school, or at least all of you, would face at least some of that. You might treat that student differently. Or a child that just cannot handle the workload. And you actually adjust their work for them. And so, I'm saying two things, am I not? Creating a structure that is fair and consistent, but also with the flexibility and being intuitive to the needs of each student. And you need to work with maybe an administrator or principal or the school board on that as to what is the flexibility in this given situation. Because there are needs sometimes that does warrant some definite differences. For instance, I'll just give this as one example. I'm not critical of a school that has a lot of things written out as far as discipline policies. And I just don't want to get into this too deeply on discipline. But some schools do. I've seen a list of those things. If they cheat, they are spanked. If they lie, they are spanked. If this happens, it's activity. I'd be curious if any of you have those policies. There is something very good about those policies because it takes the emotion out of the moment. Okay? Here's what happened, and so here's the consequences. It wasn't favoritism one time and really in a bad mood the next day. But the flip side of that is, you know what, you might get yourself in trouble sometimes with that. You might be working with a student that doesn't really feel like the wise decision to make given the situation, given how it happened, or maybe the child's background. And suddenly you're trapped in a very structured way so that my authority is exercised the same way every time, and you realize it's not really a wise choice. But that's policy, so that's what I do. Now, you're not really responsible, maybe, for the bigger policy in your school. I don't know how that all works. But again, I would caution you that as much as we want to be fair and consistent, let's not become so cold and calculating that we have just take away the fact that we have such a diversity of emotional needs in our students, and at times it does need to be adjusted and tailored for the given situation. Last of all, point four, I believe that servanthood authority provides a model worthy of imitation. So I'm going to go back to that thought. Teachers, as you go in your classroom, show the graciousness that God has shown you. And that has been a huge challenge for me recently, is I've just thought of God's graciousness. Hasn't God been awfully gracious with you? Patient, kind. As a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that love him. I think we must be impressed with the graciousness and patience of God on us. And then show that to our students. And as the longer you teach, don't allow yourself to become that cold, calculating teacher. Instead, become more of a gracious teacher that is fair, that is consistent, but is willing to show graciousness that models the authority of God over our life. Because we are shaping concepts of authority. Remember that. The father shapes concepts of authority and the mother. Very true. But so does the school. And if students leaving saying, I hate school, I'll never teach school. I'll tell you what, a teacher, wow, what a job. They're crabby. We want our students leaving school saying, here was a teacher who was gentle, kind, fair, an example, it's the best that they could be, of God's authority and graciousness, and also something that they can imitate in the administration that they will do as parents and possibly someday as teachers as well. Well, God bless you as you exercise authority this school year and pray that God would give you wisdom in every situation to exercise that authority for the best of the students. Remember, it is all about the student. Thank you. You're excused.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.